Hi, and welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Megan Figueroa.
And I'm Carrie Gillen.
You just had a birthday.
I did have a birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Was that an involuntary noise?
Yeah, I'm like, I guess it's a thing that people can't care about. I'm caring about it less and less each year.
Yeah, but anyway, what is happening in Vancouver?
Yeah, so just as a bit of background, BC municipalities are having their city elections soon. And there's 15 candidates in the city of Vancouver who wanted to have their names printed on the ballots using non-Latin characters. The court just ruled that they can, but only for this election. This is not, you know, a ruling that applies into the future. It's just for right now.
So meaning they want to have their names printed as their names truly are.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Although there's a bit of a wrinkle there because there are some people who've been given like Chinese names and they are not Chinese. And I'm not sure. I don't think that's included in this list, but it might be. And so there might be a bit of a,
Oh. Yeah.
Yes. So the city's chief election officer had challenged the names that had been submitted by candidates, including a bunch of different parties. We have, at the city level, we have a many parties, and they are not at all aligned with the federal or provincial level parties.
Interesting. Well, I was going to say 15 names. How many people?
Oof. Well, there are 10 city councilors and one mayor. Mm. And then there's, I don't remember how many is on the park board. We have a separate park board in Vancouver only, not anywhere else. Just Vancouver has its own.
Aw, you love your parks. You're like, Leslie, no.
Yes, but also it's a little bit problematic and probably shouldn't exist, but that's a whole other conversation.
Okay.
And then the school board. So there's a bunch of things being...
Oh, the school board's huge, yeah. Right?
So I don't know how many people are on that, but so there's a number of slots, and then on top of that, many people vying for each of those slots.
Right, okay. But still, I'd be like, cool, Vancouver, that you have, you know, at least 15 people that don't just have like the Latin script or their name uses the.
Okay, but here's the wrinkle.
Okay.
So one of them is Alan Wong, clearly Chinese, okay? But there's Melissa DeGenova and Iona Bonamy or Bonamis. I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name. As far as I can tell, they do not have ethnicities that would, you know, mean that they have some other script. It looks like they would have the Roman script, Latin script.
Right. Huh. So are they doing it to be assholes, is the question?
No. Pandering would be...
Oh, pandering.
Yeah. So they wanted to have them in either Chinese or Persian. Because, like, there's a pretty big Persian enclave here. So, those are the two. Basically, the judge said, look, I can't really fully hear a challenge on this right now. There's not enough time. So, okay, yes, put them on the ballot, but this does not count for future. We'll have to have a full decision-making process later.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I just realized, okay, so, yeah, I have never seen a different script on any of my election materials. So, we have the same problem here.
The problem's different, right? Because here, lots of material is printed in Hindi, probably simplified Chinese, maybe also traditional, I'm not sure.
Right.
Persian, Arabic. I mean, there's like, the election materials are in other scripts. It's just the ballot. I think this is the first time that they've tried.
Oh, that's what I mean. So, like, our ballot is never going to have, like...
Probably not.
Right. Or hasn't to this point. And maybe that'll change. Mm-hmm. But I've never thought about it before.
It probably wouldn't be Arizona that would change it first. It'd probably be more likely a place like California or Washington or somewhere where there are large populations. Like, the population in Arizona is pretty small, right?
Yeah. Oh, but I don't think that they use accent marks.
Right. That's true. So there's not even accent marks. That's true.
Yeah. Which is a very big problem in Arizona, Tucson.
It's true.
Tucson might change it.
Yes.
We have a great county recorder here. I just realized how offensive that is. Because I don't have one. So I'm like, not personally thinking about it.
Right.
But it doesn't mean it's not happening. I need to think outside of myself here. And I'm like, wow, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one of the few things that is like, has to be the case here in Canada. Because of French, you have to be able to put on the accents.
Oh, and you people care about French up there.
We have to.
Yeah, you have to. So you've had accent marks, but you...
But other things
don't have it, of course. Yeah.
I mean, maybe in Nunavut, which is Inuit, like vast majority Inuit, I wouldn't be surprised if up there the ballots were also in the syllabics writing system. So there's like at least that location that might already have had other characters, but I don't know for sure. I haven't looked it up.
Yeah. Well, and then so pandering never occurred to me.
I don't remember who it was, but one of the city councilors claimed that she was called Wise Flower in Chinese, whatever that is. Don't know, sorry.
Uh-huh. Right.
And so that's why she wanted to have it on her ballot. I think that's what she was saying. But anyway, so she definitely claimed that she had been called Wise Flower. And everyone's like, what? How did this come up? Like, who would be calling? Anyway, it may be the case, but it just seems like a really strange nickname to have received. And then to try to put that on the ballot seems disingenuous to me.
Oh, super disingenuous. And of course, it's another case of a politician or whatever, assuming that people aren't very smart, that we're so, you know, like these are the things that appeal to people without any further thought to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing. I'm obviously pro putting non-Latin characters on the ballot, but also some people make it harder to support.
No, I know, because you're like, you can't just say, but you can't do it. You can do it, but you can't do it, or something, right? Like, how do you do that?
I mean, I guess you could do something like, it's hard, but it has to be your actual name. It can't be a nickname.
Mm.
And there's still a way of transliterating most names into it, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong about that. Certain scripts you can do it, for sure.
Yeah.
But maybe not Chinese, I don't know. But anyway.
Were the other people using, like, their legal name just to be in Chinese script for no reason? Or are they claiming nicknames, too?
I don't know for sure, actually. Yeah. It's a good question. I don't know.
Wow. Wow. So I'm guessing they'd be side by side.
Yeah, it would all be on the same... I think it would all be on the same line, basically. Mm-hmm. So my guess is it's probably going to be the Latin first, no matter what. And then if you have another name in another script, that would probably be second.
Well, I'm glad Alan Wong is getting this opportunity, but... What was the DeGrazia or whatever? Wise Flower? I mean, you're right. Like, what community of Chinese folks in Vancouver are hanging around her just calling her Wise Flower is what I want to know.
Yeah, it kind of feels like a fake name.
Right.
But what do I know? This is not my thing.
Yeah, you don't know her or whatever, but it does feel disingenuous.
Okay, so I looked up. So Kennedy Stewart, who is the current mayor and is running again for mayor, he has won a Chinese name. But basically, it's just a transliteration of his last name, Kennedy.
Okay.
Ganaidi? I don't know. Something like that. It doesn't feel like a plausible Chinese name. It's just telling you how to pronounce it. But that's, I mean, at least there, it's like, well, you know, this is just an English name.
Yeah.
Let's see. Mike Hurley is in Burnaby, which is the suburb to the east of us. Also has one. Let's see, what is his? His basically is actually thoroughly Chinese. So it's Hu for Hurley and Mai Hao for Mike. But those are actually Chinese names. And it's something like Lordship and Marching Grandly.
Oh. Huh.
And the mayor of Richmond, which is to the south of Vancouver and actually My parents know him. Mm. They're friends.
Oh.
He also has a Chinese name. And Richmond is maybe the most like Chinese suburb of Vancouver.
Uh-huh.
So if they don't, if the Chinese population there didn't like you, you probably couldn't get elected. His given name is Malcolm, and he goes so by Ma, which means horse. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. I know that because of the tones.
There's four. Yeah, you could be saying mother. Who knows?
Four in Mandarin, nine in Cantonese, I think.
Oh my god!
And then his Chinese last name Baoding, which is I guess kind of close to Brody, means guaranteed defender.
Well, that's convenient. That's a good like politician name.
That is pretty good. Yeah. So anyways, it's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I'll be interested to see where this goes, since this will probably or will definitely be what the judge is gonna deal with it again, or someone's gonna bring it up again to the
Yeah, they're gonna have to and probably right after the election deal with this because yeah.
Yeah.
This, we at least need to know, like, I don't know, is it a free-for-all? Maybe.
Right.
Maybe that's okay. Or right. Is it, like, no, this really does have to be your legal name in some sense. Although how, because we don't have, it's not your legal Canadian name, so I don't know.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, it's interesting. It's an interesting puzzle, and I hope they figure out a way to do it that's fair.
Yeah, that's fair. That's genuine.
But maybe that the only way to do that is just have a free-for-all.
Yeah. And know that people can probably see right through you.
Yeah.
If, you know.
Yeah.
You're just pandering.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Super interesting.
Happy election season to British Columbians and voting in the municipal elections.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, so today's episode, we talk with a former guest again.
Yes, friend of the pod.
Mm-hmm.
About a book.
About his brand new book that just came out.
Yeah, so exciting. We hope you enjoy.
Enjoy.
So, we have a repeat guest today.
Yeah.
We really do, and it's because we love him. Friend of the pod. Friend of the pod. Dr. J.P.B. Gerald is an educator and theorist seeking justice for the racially, linguistically, and neurologically minoritized, and the author of Antisocial Language Teaching, English, and the Pervasive Pathology of Whiteness. And I want to read you the blurb about the book, which is fantastic. So, the Centering of Whiteness in English Language Teaching, ELT, renders the industry callous, corrupt, and cruel, or antisocial. Using the diagnostic criteria for antisocial personality disorder as a rhetorical device, this book examines major issues with the ideologies and institutions behind the discipline of ELT and diagnoses the industry as in dire need of treatment, with the solution being a full decentering of whiteness. A vision for a more just version of ELT is offered as an alternative to the harm caused by present-day incarnation. With unique linkage of discourse on whiteness, language, and ability, this book will be necessary reading for students, academics, and administrators involved in ELT around the world. Thank you so much for being here again.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, no, I really wanted to come back. I told you all because when I was here, I don't know, it was like September 2020 or something like that.
Oh, my God. When we all thought we were going to get sick and perish.
Yeah.
But you were just a new dad, too. Oh, so much for you.
Which like a lot of the books about that, right?
Yeah.
Right about that time. So, but so I said, you know, when I write this book, cause they were talking about it with me, but it wasn't confirmed yet. I said, I'm going to come back. So I wrote the book.
And now you're back. Here. Yeah. And you finished a book during COVID. I have been holding up our book during COVID. So I just want to say what an undertaking that you have done here. Was it some sort of like outlet for you that was healthy or like cathartic?
I think, as you can tell from what's actually in the book, there's definitely a lot of catharsis in there.
There is, yeah.
I don't have a whole lot of, you know, sometimes when I'm working out a thought that I want to go in the book, the working out of the thought goes into the book. And that, I think, made it so if I was working on an idea, it was easy to go and put it on the paper. And then once I got rolling, then it sort of felt like an achievement. I was just like, it's the same with reading. Like if I'm reading something and like sometimes it takes me a little bit to get going, but then there's like a tipping point where you're just like now I'm going to read this whole thing in 2 minutes. Felt that way with the writing too. It took a while to get into the flow. For a while, it was just a series of obligations to just like, you're gonna, I had it. It was every Saturday night because like there was nowhere to go. So
it's true. It's true.
Every Saturday night at 8 o'clock, I was going to be working on the book and have a certain amount of words written as a minimum. And I also, at the same time, told myself, but don't just get carried away on those days. Save a little bit of that energy. So if I told myself I was going to write 1,500 words, I think I put as a thing. And I started with a section that I knew would be easy to write. So then I hit it the first time, and they gave me like, okay, I can do this.
That is really good advice. This is really good advice, actually, you're giving. Like,
it's called parking on the downslope.
Yeah, oh. Exactly.
Or eating the frog first or something, right? Like, there's another...
No, that's eating the frog first is a different piece of advice.
Okay.
The opposite piece of advice, in fact.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's about doing the hardest thing first, right?
Right. Yeah, this is about doing the easiest thing first. Yeah.
To get the momentum, to get into flow. Yeah.
Right. Yes. Like, I can do this. And then there were certainly sections that were harder to write. And notably, it was the sections where I had to do more research because I was like,
of course.
Yes.
Always.
I should say, when I mean hard, I literally just mean harder to get the words out. But there were plenty of sections that moved quickly, but were very hard. Do you know?
I know. Yes.
Maybe I should refer to the speed. Like, I would get it done regardless, but there were times when it would take me like an hour, and times when it would take me like the whole like rest of the night. You know, right. I didn't let myself go to sleep unless it was done. Eventually, I'd get faster and faster, and it was, get muscle memory. But so there were definitely sections where, like, because I've gone back to read it a few times, not because I'm just like, oh, that's luxuriating in my accomplishment, but because
but
I had
you should.
To. I had to. When I get the actual physical copy, I'll do that.
Yeah. Yes. But you really left yourself on the page. It makes it, I mean, obviously, things like that always make things more compelling.
There was a book that I cited in there briefly called The Limits of Whiteness by Neda Magbula, who's at the University of Toronto, but I think she's somewhere else for like 2 years. You know, I'm academics all over the place. I don't know. But anyway, her book, and she was on my podcast a couple of years ago, it was written that way, not exactly the same way. Hers had more research in it than mine, but I don't mean to imply that there's none, people. But it's still, she sounded like a person in the book,
mm-hmm.
but it was still technically an academic book. And so when I talked to her, and I talked to her like the week before the contract was official, so off air we talked about this, you know, it made me think that I actually could write it the way that I would have wanted to write it. You know, I was expecting that I would write it, however, and that when the edits came back, I'd have to like really change it. I really didn't change the book that much.
That's awesome.
Yeah. The edits. There have been journal articles that like, or chapters, technically chapters, like an academic chapter. There are chapters that I wrote in early 2020, 8 months before the book was contracted, that have not been released in the books yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, book chapters are the worst because you don't know if they're even ever going to get out.
Yeah. But this is coming out because...
This is coming out.
This is for real.
I also saw, I believe... that you are now a doctor, yes?
Yes!
Yeah, it was a... Even ignoring what was happening in the world and all that, it was definitely, just in terms of the studies, although I can't completely separate it because a lot of what I wrote is about that, but just an interesting time to get a chance. And it was the first time I feel like I had as much agency as a student, you know, which is supposed to be how doctoral programs go, right? But, like, I didn't... The other times, I just sort of felt like I was in school... Because that's what it's time to be in school, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, and then even when I went to get my teaching degree, you know, which was a few years after college ended, it's because I was already working as a teacher. And I was like, well, I might as well go get it. So it never felt like I just like, what do I want to like think about?
speaking of what you want to think about, you were writing this during your doctoral program. Why did you want to write this book?
So in fall of 2020, I was working on just an independent study project that was a short, not short, but like journal article length. I don't know if I would have put it in a journal. Like, I don't know if that was my goal, but just in terms of length, it's like 7,000-8,000 words kind of thing. And it was going to be about what I was coming to find the intersection between whiteness and ability, right? That I was just sort of learning about, and it was during a time when I was figuring out stuff with my own neurology. I didn't really have a language component in it. I was just going to write this essay, and while I was writing it, the language, the article that you all had me on here for 2 years ago, the whiteness and language teaching article, was like, I was getting talks and all that. So I got interest from a publisher on the language side, but at the same time, I was working on this whiteness and ability essay, and I was like, I can't add more work to this. What if I use what I'm already doing? Like, so how can I bring the connection here? And I really thought about it. I was like, is this going to seem shoehorned, you know? And then I really started to look at it, and it actually started to fit. So I used that essay's beginning and then added a bunch of research about language and put it together as the pitch to the publisher. And then they liked it. And I was like, now I have to write a book and a dissertation at the same time. The gray hair on my chin, which you can't hear, but it's from this. Like, it's not from the child. Like, I have had the child for 2.5 years now, and there was no gray hair the first year, right? And that was like the scary in 2020 and so forth, and the first year, and it's a baby, and you're like, no gray hair. No gray hair. The gray hair, yeah. Because I took some professional pictures in early 2021 because I didn't have any recent ones, and I was giving all these talks. No gray hair. No gray hair. And then, so, you know, it's just, I mean, I'm like, but now I have, you know, I can get into that later, but now I had less pressure overall because I finished all of the things. So yeah, now right. I'm really at this point just waiting for people to read it.
Yeah, speaking of letting people read it, let's talk about it. Yeah. So it's the same kind of stuff we talked about with you before, but maybe you have a different perspective on it now that you've written this book and you're finished your doctoral degree. So what is centering whiteness and how do we decenter it?
Yeah. So to go back to the previous article, right, which was that, like literally that was the title. You know, when I wrote that, what I was trying to get at is that there's an ideal that is often unspoken when people are saying that you need to speak English or use English in this particular way. People will say that it's just the forms, right? The words, sounds, so forth, the accent, right? But we are pretending that this is not attached to a certain person or people, right? And so it's really the hierarchization where you can use all the adjectives you want, but often associated with white English, because you could say standardized, you know, yeah, there's a lot of different things you could say, is just placed at the top, and everyone who's learning the language is trying to reach that. So to decenter it would not be to not include the forms that people tend to use, which comes up a lot when you talk about challenging the standards. They're like, well, what would people learn? It's like they would be okay.
Yeah.
But it means, you know, an even playing field, right? You know, within the language, right? You know, the language is not going to not exist. So, and people are going to want to learn it. So if they're going to be taught the language, what is going to be considered right, wrong? What's going to be considered closer to the expectation? And I don't even think that you cannot teach, or I don't even think that's just think it's bad to teach certain forms of the language if they're placed in context. You know, like the lacking context is a lot of what the issue is. Sure, you can come up with a version of the language that's really specific to a culture that is therefore like raised up in that classroom, and that's great. But honestly, like, I don't even think it would be bad to teach a lot of the English that's taught if we just placed it in context, you know, because that means that it's not just an unspoken norm at the center, right? We can understand that it's part of the language, and we can accept that or reject it or whatever, but right now it's just there in the background. Well, not always the background, but in the center. And for the many things I say in the book, you know, there are ways that we don't have to leave it there.
Being honest about, right, that's like a huge way to decenter it, right? Is to say the unspoken parts.
Yeah, it's at the center, but it's unspoken, yeah. Right? And naming it is in a useful way, in a way that, because, you know, when I get into the standardized English part of the book, and talking about why standard English is a harmful term, but we should not pretend that a standard has not been created.
Right.
Right.
It has been. Like, one of the stories I tell in the book is when I was in a class and I had two classmates arguing, and one was saying that, of course, there's a standard English, and one was saying there is no standard English. And I was saying, I don't really agree with either of them, right? Just, it's like, there is no, like, organic, perfect English that just came out of the sky. But we cannot pretend that a bunch of people for however many centuries did not make a standard.
We just have to
include the fact that the people made it as part of the teaching.
Right. And why they made it. Like, why the particular forms were chosen. Like, who were the people speaking those forms at the time and now?
Helping people get rid of the idea that there's something inherent in the language that makes one form better than the other.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with the language bit. It's the context of who's using the language.
It's the people.
Yeah,
I think that, unfortunately, in the past especially, and maybe it's still true depending on where you are, we don't think of a language as being attached to a people unless it's attached to a people we don't like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. We only pick on the language of, people we don't like.
Right. It is, you know, it's disembodied unless it's a bad body.
And then it's really bodied. Yes.
Right.
If we think of other people's intelligence or bodies or whatever it is as the reason why they do things that we don't like, then we're missing the plot.
Yep. Yes. And we're cruising into ableism and eugenics. Let's talk about that, because I think that this is a big difference between your article and this book, is how much you mention disability critical studies, so DISCRIT. So can you tell us about what you mean by pathology of whiteness?
Yeah, so that is really the main difference between the article and the book, aside from the length. It's that the two main differences are there's a bunch about me and there's a bunch about ability and disability, right? The way that I'm using pathology and pathologization, which, let me tell you, as many talks as I've given, I'm trying to say that word a lot.
I know. Ditto.
I'm just like, pathology. And also hierarchization.
Ooh, this, yeah.
It's all vowels.
Yeah, too many vowels.
Yep.
So anyway, when I was looking at, and the specifics of why I chose antisocial is, by chance, it was in the Tucker Carlson quote. It's in the book as to why it's called that. It's in the Tucker Carlson quote, and it seems like it's the way people think of, like, the worst people. And when I was looking at that, I was just reading DSM because my wife has it because she's a social worker originally. And I'm just looking at, like, what do these criteria actually say? They're so vague. I understand that, therefore, it's up to interpretation, but then how are you going to try to codify the interpret? You know what I'm saying? Like I understand certain things that you've written down, but you're leaving it so open to a person's judgment, which, sure, that's important, but then this judgment isn't being questioned for these issues of power and so forth. So the way that people can be classified as disordered, right, or is not working correctly. But then when you start to think about what does order mean and who determines what order is, right? And the book does not claim saying that no one needs support for issues, right? I have had issues and needed support for them. I'm not saying that. But when you think about who has been seen as not acting the right way, you know, when you think about how those ideas about the right way were constructed, what it means to, you know, fit into society, what is society, right? Who's running this society? You know, you can see how people, especially if they can't work correctly, right, are going to be seen as, you know, not worth the support and deserving of their place. Yeah, that's a lot of it. It's not just that they are over there, but that they deserve to be over there.
Can we actually just mention what he actually says, just to contextualize this antisocial bit? So he says, BLM and Antifa, crazed ideologues, grifters, criminals, antisocial thugs with no stake in society and nothing better to do than hurt people and destroy things.
To be clear, the he right. is Tucker
yes,
Carlson.
Yes, yes, not you, yes. That, say, sorry, say yeah, yeah.
There's a lot in there. The thugs part, obvious to anyone who's ever listened to the show before, but so I don't really go into that. It's like, well,
yes.
we know what he's doing.
Yes, yeah. but, yes. That's easy to say.
You know, that book's been written. But to me, the antisocial stuck out at me because I have seen it, and I don't know if I can prove this, but I feel like I've seen that as, like, shorthand for, like, really bad behavior more often recently. Not sure why. Maybe I've been paying attention, but I mean more recent. I mean, before I wrote the book. Like, I've just been, like, all of a sudden I'm just seeing, like, antisocial now. And I don't just mean looking up true crime because, yeah, okay. But I mean, like, just regularly. Right.
Yeah. A quick aside about true crime, though, the Satanic Panic, they would describe the, like, you know, what was happening as making kids antisocial. Like, the antisocial was a big part of the West Memphis 3 and Damien Eccles yep. being antisocial and all that. So it's a thing.
Yeah. I guess I kind of forgot about that. Like, I mean, when you, as soon as you brought up Eccles, I remembered it. But, like, the rest of the Satanic Panic, I didn't connect antisocialness with it, so that's interesting.
Yeah, with the antisocial thing, you know, yeah, so I thought that was being used as shorthand, and I realized it's also, like, what the actual clinical diagnosis for, like, sociopaths is, because that's not, you can't go to the doctor and they say you're a sociopath, right. Like, it'll be this.
No, it's not in the DSM.
Yeah, right. It'll be this or something else, or supposed to be, like, the worst of the worst, and then, like, you look at it so vague, and I realized that, like, I thought of the fury in his quote, you know, or the fury that people get from watching him, because he always doesn't sound, he doesn't sound angry, he sounds like he's confused. I don't know why he talks like that.
He always so, yeah, he's got that look on his face, like,
yeah,
I don't get it. I don't understand why it's appealing to his viewers. I do not understand. But
yeah. Intonation, the Seth Meyers is a really great impersonation of it. And he really gets down to, he's like, he's asking a question or something, or confused yeah. at all times.
He's just asking questions about these antisocial thugs. But yeah, so I thought about that, and then I started to think about, you know, how so many groups of people have been classified as, you know, deficient or defective, you know, to get back to the eugenics conversation. And it's not, there have always been people who had impairments, right? Just since there have been people, right? Whether that's physical, mental, whatever it is, right? That's just people. But, you know, we didn't think of it in the way that we think of it until, like, well, now you can't do this job, or now you can't do this, or and it was all about what you couldn't do, as opposed to just whatever it is that you actually were. Now, most of the book I'm talking about, you know, emotional and mental things, is part of the book ties into my mentioning, you know, my own, like, ADHD diagnosis and how that shaped my interest in, you know, looking at what it means to be, you know, disordered, right? Like, officially disordered. I don't know that I was rejecting the word disorder as such, but just like English, I was trying to put the word into its context to say that it's not just this organic thing. I mean, sure, the way my brain works is some organic thing, but the fact that it is a disorder is not an organic thing.
Right.
Right? It's constantly,
because in a totally different society, it wouldn't even exist. Like, it wouldn't be a thing.
Right. It would just be Justin, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Right, like, overlapping speech, so thinking about ADHD, which I have as well, one of the, like, clinical markers is that I've been reading this stuff, is, like, children with ADHD will do a lot of crossover talk, or, like, not really know conversational boundaries. And I'm like, that's Mexican Americans too.
Yeah.
Like, wait a second. This is what's in the literature, or, you know, what people are going off of. And it's like, what's wrong with these things? And when did we decide that it wasn't quote unquote normal?
Yeah, you know, because one of the criteria for antisocial is, like, that they can't hold down a job. Again, obviously, just not having a job does not mean, like, oh, you got, oh, you know, obviously.
Right.
Even in the DSM, you're supposed to have at least 5 out of the 7 with almost any of the things, right? But still, if you could go from not antisocial to antisocial because of your inability to hold down a job, like, I don't know that, like, because there's a lot of reasons why you might not be able to hold down a job.
Right.
You know? So I understand what they're trying to say, which is that, like, they can't get along with their coworkers or, you know, that, like, I get what they're trying to say, but the top line is not that.
Right. Right.
The top line is just a statistic or something like that. And who has often had trouble holding down jobs. I can see why a psych person might be mad at me for the rhetorical device I'm using, because I'm not using it very precisely, but I'm using it to, you know, start discussions about things and also question the DSM anyway. So I don't really care.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I thought you did a beautiful job of that. So then how does the pathologization of language serve whiteness and white supremacy?
Like all these things, the whole point is that these things, at least in my view, and the argument I'm making, that they're tied together. As the book in the beginning tries to make clear, I don't think anyone's surprised, you would hope, that like whiteness sort of depends upon diminishing blackness, right? And it's not news, right? I think it's a little bit of news to tie that to ability, because people just may not have been thinking about that, but that's kind of the whole of what Discrit is about. Right? It's bringing those two things together. So basically, if you knew anything about disability justice, you knew that, but a lot of people don't, so that'll be a revelation to some folks. That's not my research. That's me recounting research to get to my point. Like, you know. But then to think about what do we mean when we say able, right? What do we mean when we say intelligent, right? Like, what do we mean? And a lot of the time, that really is tied to the way that we communicate. You know, you say, you know, I remember, and I'm not trying to criticize this person, but like I was, when we were visiting daycares before he was born, right? And we were talking with the proprietors, you know, whatever. And we didn't end up going to any of these because of everything that happened. Got a new daycare a year and a half later. But anyway, and one woman said that this one baby was very smart because he talked a lot, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I also know that that's why they said I was smart. And if you are talking a lot, but what you're saying isn't right, you know, like it's very easy for that potential benefit of being seen as smart from your language to not be a benefit because you're not saying the right thing. You're not saying things in the right way. You know, if you are, if you look at the definition of an English learner, right, it's just is English, not necessarily the language spoken at home, even if you speak everything the way you're supposed to say it, right? Or quote-unquote supposed to say it. You could come to school saying everything, but if you're not saying English the right way, they're still not going to see you as intelligent or see you as intelligent as they may have seen you otherwise. I think, honestly, language is one of the axes of oppression that, I mean, you all know is what show's about, that is often under-discussed outside of the language community. I think it's under-discussed for a reason, because we depend on it. So I think that to question the power involved in our own language is hard for people, because then they're just, people don't like changing their words and changing the way they think about their words, right, and that sort of thing. See how people react to this. But I also think it's necessary for the continuation of whiteness, white supremacy, and so forth, because the way that people communicate is a big part of the project. They have to change the way people communicate to dominate them, right? You think about all the different versions of imperialism that involve crushing languages. You know, that's not just a byproduct of moving people around. Like, that's part of it. You're not making sure people can't communicate with one another.
Yeah, right? For uprisings, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or making it so that their culture is not transmitted as effectively, so they're no longer a cohesive unit, so you can steal their land more easily.
Yeah.
Yes.
All of these ideologies, they really are sorting tools.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. They're like, how can we place people according to the things that we think about them collectively?
The evil sorting hat.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Of whiteness.
Yeah. And it changes, too. Right? You know, one of the things I tried to say in the beginning, and again, this is more when I'm getting into the argument, is just like what it means to be white changes all the time, right?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, yes.
But if there wasn't a blackness, or there wasn't a wrong way to speak English, or there wasn't a disability to be better than, then what would it be? What would be left? What is it without its domination? And I think that it wouldn't have been nearly as effective and continue to be nearly as effective as a system if it weren't for the way language is used within it and used to uphold it. There's been a lot of talk about how to challenge racism the last couple of years. And sure, obviously language was originally my field, so that's the angle I came at it from, whatever. But I think that any successful challenge to racism is going to involve a deep understanding of language and its place there. You know, I don't just want, in some way, through the writing I'm doing and the talking and all of that, to challenge, you know, these systems within language teaching. I want to use the power of language to challenge it outside of language teaching, because I'm not even a language teacher anymore. So doing it inside of language teaching is going to be for everyone else to do.
Yeah,
actually, that's one of the questions we had was like, so what can people inside of language teaching do? And then those of us who are outside of the language teaching sphere, what can we do?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the climax of the book. So I don't want to give it away. But I'm going to summarize it. Yeah, exactly. You know, I sort of go through all of the arguments of why, you know, the centering of whiteness is harmful. And then I talk about the research I did for my dissertation. And also for the book, I just used a different chunk of the research where I was interviewing white teachers who I taught about whiteness. And they went back to their institutions, mostly universities, but not all, to try to do stuff. They told me what they were planning to do beforehand, and then I interviewed them to be like, so what happened? Now, admittedly, I was kind of in a rush, so it might have been better to wait longer to see what happened, because these things take a while. And I actually did get an update from one of the people in the book who told me that the project he tried to do, it had fallen apart, but it actually happened a year later. So, you know.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I'm just encouraging they kept at it. But anyway, the point being, what I learned from those interviews and from the others for my dissertation is the overall lesson, and I think this is hard for people will hear these words and understand it intellectually, but not understand it. It's in their bones until they do it. And that's specifically that it's like a lifelong, full life endeavor. You know, like the 7 specific pieces of advice that are in the book, part of, because I don't like making lists at all, but I understand it's easy to organize information that way. So it's 7 items. However, each item is like months of work. So it's not like, it's like change this entire thing about the system. So it's like, you know, it's not like go, you know, you can go home and like send 7 emails and you're done. So it's a list. There's no numbers, but there are 7 of them. So I'm leaving that in the book. But what they are all concerned with, which is the final conclusions of my dissertation, which I can talk about because I don't care. So I'm like hiding it from anybody. Is the fact that it's hard for people to really understand how much of your life you have to devote to trying to challenge these issues if you don't want to remain consistently perpetuating. We all are to some extent, but there are
complicit.
You know,
we are complicit. Right,
we're all complicit, but you know, you could be more and less complicit. Like,
yes,
you can make choices.
Exactly.
And so, like, what some of the participants, not the ones in the book, but people told me was that, like, you know, they all tried to do X and the project did what it did or didn't do. That's not the important part. I mean, I know that it's hard to change institutions, but I kind of knew that before I interviewed them, right? It was what they told me about their lives outside of work that was interesting to me. And it was how, like, not just from my class, I'm not taking the credit for changing their lives or anything like that, but they, you know, after, at least after, you know, I'm saying it was because, but after my class, they realized, like, different relationships that they had to have. You know, they thought about the relationships that their children might have to have with their grandparents, and maybe that would have to be, they found things out about their parents that they, you know, hadn't. And, like, it's not, like, fun, you know? You know, like, I think that you know, I'm not saying one shouldn't do this, but like going to a protest or something like that, that's a great thing to do. And I'm not saying people shouldn't do that. And it says explicitly in the book, like, keep doing that. But when protest's over,
what's next?
Yeah,
what's next? And I you know, if you're the person organizing the protest, I'm not talking about you, but if you were the person organizing the protest, you don't need to listen to me. So whatever. You already know what you're doing. But the people who are just on sort of sidelines, but they're sympathetic, which is mostly who I'm writing to, right? People who are sympathetic, but...
And that's a lot of people. A lot of people are like that.
Well, yeah. That's my audience is that group of people. I'm not arguing with people completely on the other side of me. I'm not the people who already... You know, obviously the people like you all who agree with me, great. But like, you know, that's fine. But you all need my help. But the people who broadly agree, who, you know, there's probably things in it I don't agree with, but they agree with the thrust of it, but are just sort of like, you know, I don't even know, you know. And that to me is the real crisis, is that group of people, because I get it, because I was that person for a while, and I was just like, I got so much to, I don't, you know, I do what I can. And as I said early in the book, I used to think just being a black face in that classroom, no, I think it was a different article, but whatever, being black face in that classroom was different enough. Like, I don't have to do more. But what actually set me on this path, and we can talk about this aspect of the book after I say this, if you want, was like, when I was a regular classroom language teacher 8 years ago, something like that, I was at my master's program would put on, like, we would come together and talk about teaching afterwards, like after I graduated. And I was like, all right, cool. I used to like organize it with the director of the program. And one of the people did a presentation that was about her life as an adjunct, right? Now, I had adjuncting jobs and I knew that they were terrible, like the jobs that I had. I was not thinking that they would not be terrible. I just knew, I was like, it's just going to be bad. It's going to be a bad situation. What I saw her do was present her extremely stressful professional situation as a really fun thing. And I'm just like, do you believe that? Or do you have to believe that in order to do it?
Right.
And I don't blame anyone for just making the peace with what situation they're in, because otherwise you're just going to sink into the quicksand, you know? And I get it, right? You know, I've had jobs like that. Like I said, I was an adjunct. But I said, you know, I thought about that for a while because I was so confused. I was like, why is this being presented? Like, why is this being... She wasn't making fun of herself. She wasn't like comedy. She was just like talking about like how I balance four jobs. And I'm like, what the... It's just like, and not only is that common in the field, right? Not only is the lack of income in that way common in the field, which is a problem, but that's a problem in a lot of fields. What I found interesting was the cheerfulness about it, like the attitude about it. And again, not just like keeping yourself together, but like we were all supposed to just accept the way the field was. And be happy about it and be like, it's so rewarding to do this volunteer job. And I'm just like, I would like to have a rent to pay.
Yes.
I would like to be able to pay it. You know, and I don't mean, I wasn't trying to be greedy about it. I didn't, you know, I was not, you know, I had various nonprofit jobs after that. Like I still have a nonprofit job, but I had like the typical nonprofit job, you know, because the language, I was running a language teaching program. And like, yeah, I really wasn't making a lot of money, but I was able to pay my rent. And because after she said that, I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. In this book, not only do I talk about capitalist exploitation and so forth, a little bit, it's not like a lot of the book, but I really want the field to have to think about itself. Everyone in the field wants to reform the field in this way. Well, you know, I go to a conference and they're like, here's a new tech tip. And I'm like, okay. And I see this talk, and it's like the most popular talk at TESOL 2017 was like, how to use TED Talks in class. I'm like, it's not hard. you just put it on screen.
Yeah.
Wow.
What is the presentation? Is the presentation just a bunch of TED Talks? What's happening here?
Wow.
Like, I'm sympathetic, and I said there's a whole chapter about the fact that people are being exploited in their workplaces, and that's not just this field, but it's very much this field. And so I do understand if people are just being kicked in the head all day and they just can't. But that's not everyone. So there's enough people who understand that this is messed up and have more than zero power.
Right.
But not 100% of the power, because even 100% of the power are benefiting from it. But, like, people who have more than zero power, who could be using that power to shift the way these things are taught and thought about and, you know, spoken about and presented on and everything.
Well, your book is certainly one really good resource that people are going to have within ELT, and they better fucking buy it. Because,
yes,
it's just well done. And people need to hear this stuff.
I mean, I feel lucky in the sense that, like, I can't believe that this happened. A whole lot of things had to happen for this to happen. And that's true of everything. But, like, you know, I was not planning to do this when I did it. I, at the time, and I guess I can reveal this now, it was like, I was really in a bad way when I got this book deal. It had nothing to do with the book. But, like, I had almost lost my job in 2020, and I did not. And so, therefore, many people were way worse off than I was, but still stressful.
Right, yeah, with a new baby, yeah.
Yeah, and I was worried about healthcare for him. And I didn't lose a job, but, like, I had to change things up and, like, really do things differently in a way that made it so I had to spend less time with him for a couple of months to, like, you know, do stuff. And, you know, I saved that job, and then the book deal happened, and all of it only happened because I wrote an article that was published, like, the same week as all this stuff in May of 2020, right. You know?
Yeah.
And then people wanted to talk to me, and the publisher saw something I did, and then she approached me, and then I ended up writing it really fast, and so it's coming out, like, 8 months before it was supposed to come out, so.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yes, look at this. I mean, with all that you did, you have gifted the world with this, which I think will be muchly cited.
Yeah, I think so, too. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about it with us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You know, it's folks like you where the people who I need to convince to do stuff are the main audience for the book, obviously. And the people who, you know, fully disagree, whatever. And then the people who I already rock with, like, you all weren't the main targets for the book, but you all were the people I wanted to be sure would enjoy the book.
Aww. Well, I did. I was like, he is getting, look at his point. Look at his point. Oh, he's going. He's still going. He's still going. This is it.
Yeah, I did not have enough energy to stop myself from saying everything that I wanted to say.
Oh, but you, oh, it was good.
Yeah,
it was good.
It's really good. And I do think that you know, if people know the structure, like, that you talk about the disorder and then you talk about the symptoms and then, you know, the treatment. I think that's really clever. And I think it's also
so
going to be very helpful for people to unpack their own shit, because we all have it and we all need to unpack it. So I think you did a good job of helping people.
Absolutely. A+ rhetorical device.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's great.
Yeah, the reviewer liked it too.
Oh, I bet. And we always leave our listeners with one final message. Don't be an asshole.
Don't be an asshole.
'Alright, we have new patrons to thank for this month.
Yay!
Yeah. Yay. Thank you, Jeanette Latruit, I think.
I'm so glad you're the one that reads the names.
I still think I mangled that one. Thank you, Neil Goldfarb.
Yay!
And thank you, Brendan Ray.
Yay! We really appreciate it.
We really, really do.
If you want to just celebrate Carrie. Patreon is a great way to do it.
Yes. Patreon.com/vocalfriespod. And if you join us at the $5 a month level or above, you get bonus episodes.
It's true. There's so many. And they are fun.
They are fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
What did we talk about last time?
You talked to me about the courts or the judge using corpus linguistics to decide to lift mask mandates.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Oof. It was definitely interesting topic and also infuriating.
Yeah.
So if you enjoy interesting and infuriating conversations, which if you're listening to this, you probably do.
Right.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.